Tax Update for Saturday, January 13th, 2007. Welcome to Tax Update for Saturday, January the 13th, 2007. This week, put on notice, the IRS explains the Pension Protection Act of 2006 distribution provisions. The Tax Update podcast is intended for tax professionals and is not designed for those not skilled in independent tax research. All readers and listeners are expected their own research to confirm items raised in this presentation before relying upon the positions presented. The podcast and the supporting documents may be reproduced freely so long as no fee is charged for the use of the document or the podcast. Such a prohibited use would include using the podcast or document as part of a CP presentation for which a fee is charged. The podcast is sponsored by Lineberg Information Services, located on the web at www.lineberg-services.com. Lineberg Information Services offers email newsletters on tax-related matters, as well as access to a library of useful information to tax practitioners who subscribe to their services. Again, you can find them on the web at www.lineberg-services.com. This week, the IRS issued a notice 2007-7 that was meant to explain a number of the new distribution provisions found in the Pension Protection Act of 2006. This week, we're going to go over some of the more important ones, at least from the perspective of small, closely held companies, and take a look at the issues that we need to consider for ourselves and for our clients when we're dealing with these matters going forward. Again, there are a number of provisions in here. Some of them we're not going to really look at in detail. Others we're going to look at in more detail. I would also note that there have been two excellent presentations done, or two excellent documents written, that have been provided to Lineberg Services subscribers during this week on the issue, specifically the last one we're going to deal with, that deals with the special charitable contribution provision allowed for IRA accounts, direct contributions from an IRA account. And so you need to take a look at those if you have access to that information. But let's talk about some of these provisions. And the first one I want to look at was Act Section 826 that basically expanded hardship distribution provisions, or I should say allowed a plan to expand hardship distribution provisions. Now, the provision is not actually contained in the Internal Revenue Code. You're not going to go look in the code and find the provision here. Rather, this is a section of the Act that directed the IRS to do certain things and make certain modifications. And what it directed the IRS to do, within 180 days after the date of enactment of the Act, the IRS is supposed to modify the rules for determining whether a participant has had a hardship for purposes of Section 401(k)(2)(b)(i), and then IV, how's that for a nice detailed reference, of the code to provide that if an event, including the incurrence of a medical expense, which constitutes a hardship under the plan if occurred with respect to participant's spouse or dependent, such event shall, to the extent permitted under the plan, constitute a hardship if it occurs with respect to a person who is a beneficiary under the plan with respect to the participant. And the Secretary of the Treasury shall issue similar rules for purposes of determining whether a participant has had a hardship for purposes of Section 403B11B of the code, or an unforeseen financial emergency for purposes of 409 Cap A, a couple provisions in there, and 457. Now, Section 3 of the notice deals with this issue. And question 5 provides if a plan allows distributions only for the expenses described in Regulation 1.401(k)(1D3IIIB, it can permit distributions for expenses described basically in numbers 1, 3, and 5 of that group for a primary beneficiary. Okay, what are those ones that we can provide for a hardship distribution? And what they provide, number 1 is the medical expense deduction, basically. So we could provide for a hardship distribution for medical expenses for the, always, now we can always do it for the participant, basically spouse and dependent, but now we can do it for the primary beneficiary under the plan if the plan so allows. We also can do it for payment of tuition, related education fee, room and board expenses for up to the next 12 months. Or we could do it for payment for burial or funeral expenses for the employee's deceased parents, spouse, children, dependents, etc. Now, the notice defines a primary beneficiary under the plan, an individual who is named as a beneficiary under the plan and has an unconditional right to all or a portion of the participant's account's balance under the plan upon the death of the participant. Key issue there. First, it must be a named beneficiary. And secondly, their right to the money must be unconditional. If there's any conditions on their rights to receive the money, for instance, we're passing it through a trust that would go to them, that's not going to give us an eligible distribution purpose for purposes of the hardship distribution under these rules. Now, the notice makes it clear as well as the code does that a plan has to adopt these provisions. There is no requirement that a plan provides for a hardship distribution for beneficiaries. This provision merely permits a plan to provide for such distributions to beneficiaries. What does that mean? That means if your client comes in and he works for XYZ company, an unrelated company you have nothing to do with, and says, oh, I have this hardship and I want to take a distribution, and the hardship is with my beneficiary. The beneficiary is not my spouse or my dependent. It's somebody else. For instance, in many cases we're going to talk about, shall we say, the living companion with whom they are not married. If that is the beneficiary in question, we cannot necessarily say that, yes, you can take that distribution just because the plan allows it for dependents or for dependents or for the spouse of individuals. There's nothing in the rules that requires a plan to be modified. More importantly, even if the employer, let's say, now thinks, oh, I want to do that, until the plan is modified, this isn't an option for distribution. So it's important if you have clients who have plans and maybe want to offer this benefit or may think about trying to take advantage of it themselves, somebody important in the company or them who may want to take advantage of the hardship distribution, this needs to be in the plan document. So it's a modification that needs to be there. Now, the plan goes on to deal with the concept of an unforeseeable financial emergency under 457B and 409 Cap A and allows such plans to treat the primary beneficiary in the same manner as a spouse or dependent for purposes of such emergency. The notice specifically states that we are going to have these rules will be reflected in the final regulations under 409 Cap A that we've been waiting on now for a couple of years. When those regulations come out, we are now told we will have these particular special rules in place. So we'll take a look and hopefully we'll see that coming up and we'll be able to do something along those lines. So that's the new provision. As I said, key issue to remember there, the plans have to be modified to take advantage of this provision. Now, Section 829 of the plan gets around a little problem we've had for a while. The issue has been qualified plans and non-spousal beneficiaries. Under the code, if I am a participant in a qualified plan, I pass away with an account balance. I leave that balance to my beneficiary under the plan as my spouse. My spouse can take a distribution from the plan and roll that into an IRA. Alternatively, if the plan so allows, the spouse could leave it in there and draw it out of there. So could my non-spouse beneficiary. My non-spouse beneficiary could leave it in the plan. The problem is they can't, if they take a distribution, they can't roll that into, nor can they have the custodian directly roll that into under the old law into an IRA for their benefit. Why was that a problem? Plan custodians, usually plan administrators, especially if the person in question or the family in question doesn't control the entity, may very well have little or no interest in having a lot of people in the plan who have never been employees and who are relatives and who may be on extended distribution periods that go out for decades. They really don't want those people in the plan have to mess with all that. Most of the plans are going to provide that when basically an employee dies, that distribution is going to go out to the beneficiary as soon as possible. If it was a spouse, that was no problem. They could roll to an IRA. If instead it went to a non-spouse, let's say son or daughter, grandchild, then we had an issue because that person could not roll to an IRA, could not do a direct rollover to an IRA, and so basically had to take the full distribution into income in the year that the plan kicked it out and said, sorry, we're not dealing with you any longer. The new provision in the law allows for distributions after December 31st, 2006 for a direct rollover to be provided in the plan document for a non-spousal beneficiary. Now that gives us kind of the new inherited, it's like an inherited IRA, now it's going to be the inherited plan balance, except we're going to be able to transfer that into and create the inherited IRA. Once it's in there, it's treated much like traditional inherited IRAs, same problems. We can't make additional contributions to it. We can't combine it with our own IRAs. We basically have to treat this thing sitting out here alone and take the minimum distributions. But at least we can get a stretch out if this provision is in place. Now, the notice applies, as I said, to distributions after December 31st, 2006. So distributions today will count. Now, the notice also explains that a distribution has to satisfy the general rules for an eligible rollover distribution, you know, that would normally satisfy, presuming this had been the spouse in question, and it must be made to the designated beneficiary that satisfies the rules for who is a designated beneficiary under Regulation Section 1.401A9-4. Key issue, the distribution must be made directly to the IRA that's going to hold this, the new inherited or quasi-inherited IRA, via a trustee-to-trustee transfer. Pursuant to the rules, we find in Regulations 1.401A31-1, question and answer 3 and 4. You need to take a look at those mechanical guidelines, and I've reproduced them in the materials. Now, if you don't know where to get the materials, go to my website, ezollers.libsyn.com. There will be a link on there, as well as a link on the reference on the Limeburg Services website for this particular podcast. That will give you a link to get back to get this document, the PDF file that has this in. What you need to do is go take a look at either get the document or go take a look at Regulation 1.401A31-1, Question 3 and 4, and it will tell you how we accomplish a direct rollover that satisfied those particular requirements that previously are on 401A31, as to which explains what the heck is a direct rollover. Now, the key things to note is it's got to be made by a reasonable means of direct payment. It can be a wire transfer, mailing of a check to the IRA custodian. If the payment's made by check, it must be negotiable only by the trustee or the custodian, essentially the IRA. If it's made by wire transfer, it must be directed only to the trustee of the eligible retirement plan, or in this case, the IRA custodian. The custodian takes care of that for these purposes. You can provide, as question 4 does, that you can give a check to the participant or to the beneficiary, but that particular check has to be basically name of trustee, you know, name of the custodian as custodian for the name of the IRA. So basically, he can be given the check and he can make delivery, but it cannot be a check written to the beneficiary. If John Smith is the beneficiary, we cannot have a check written to John Smith that John takes. We need a check written to the custodian of the account for Mr. Smith's father, with him as the beneficiary, and that can be cashed by the IRA custodian. He can deliver it, but basically he can play postman. He cannot have a negotiable instrument that he could cash and basically put in his bank account. If he has that, we have blown this particular provision. We no longer have an eligible rollover. We no longer have a contribution that can go into an IRA account, and at this point in time, we now have a distribution that's fully taxable to that beneficiary. Now, the types of plans that can offer this provision are described in the notice, and basically they're qualified plans as described in Section 401A. That's generally anything we normally consider to be a qualified plan. 403A and B annuity plans, and eligible government plans under 457B. Now, the notice goes on to tell us that the IRA must be titled in the name of the deceased individual and has to identify both the decedent and beneficiary. And the notice gives example of an account that Tom Smith is a beneficiary of John Smith is the way you'd reference those sorts of things for the John Smith IRA. This is found in question and answer 13 of the issue. Now, it may take a while before all of our custodians get this right, so you want to make sure you're careful and make sure the titling comes out correct. We certainly expect that we're going to see a few cases where these get set up, and instead of having it with the name as Tom Smith as beneficiary for John Smith, we're just going to get an IRA for Tom, or even worse, the custodian's going to say, oh, Tom already has an IRA with us, we'll just deposit this in Tom's IRA. Either one of those cases is a major problem under these provisions, because in both of those cases, as we read it literally, we have both a distribution that's fully taxable, but now we probably have an excess contribution to the IRA that, if not timely corrected, triggers excise taxes rolling forward. So you want to make sure these things get properly titled, and it's going to take a while probably before all the custodians get this right, so be very, very careful, or the custodians don't notice, and they believe this is a rollover from the owner's own plan account rather than the owner's rather than an inherited amount coming from the owner who is now a beneficiary. So we have a beneficiary account coming over. Be very, very careful. I can certainly see a lot of issues developing in this area over the next few months and over the next year or so until everybody gets used to this. Now, if the beneficiary is a trust and the beneficiaries of the trust meet the requirements of 401A9E, then the plan can make a direct rollover to an IRA in the name of the trust, and we look through the trust to the beneficiaries to determine our distribution numbers. Now note, plans are not required to offer this option at all. That's key. So again, you have to check the plan document. Just because John Smith walks in and says, I've inherited a balance in my father's plan, that does not mean that necessarily we're going to be able to set up this IRA, inherited IRA for him. Rather, we have to check to see if the plan in question provides for it. Now, that said, the notice in question and answer 14 makes it clear that if you do offer this benefit, you must offer it on a non-discriminatory basis. That is, the plan just can't say that only John, you know, only the owner of the company's family can get this transfer, but everybody else just has to take the money. It's got to offer the option on a non-discriminatory basis. As well as we note, you're going to have to amend the plan to offer this option. This may be important if you practice and you don't have a whole lot to do with the plan, but you have a lot to do with the tax planning for the taxpayer. You may need to make sure that the plan document they are using gets amended to include this provision if they want it. And that may require some inquiries depending upon where the plan document is coming from. If you're dealing with a plan administrator, an independent plan administrator, you're probably going to have no problem getting this solved. If you have a client who decided to do this on the cheap and find XYZ's, you know, kind of plan sitting off to the side that was adopted through some other means, let's say a brokerage firm or an insurance company, and it's just a, you know, standard issue plan, they're going to have to do some inquiries to discover, first, is that going to be offered as an option to the plan? Number two, are they going to have to do some work like make an adoption or modify their adoption agreement and adopt a new plan to get this provision into the plan, because it needs to be there before we can take advantage of this provision, so be very careful there. Now, the notice goes on to note there are a few things this is not subject to. The mandatory requirements of 401A31 for a direct rollover doesn't have to be offered, but if it does, then the rollover, we look to those rules to determine if we have a valid direct rollover. We don't have to worry about the notice requirements of 402F or the mandatory withholding requirements of 3405C. As well, if the amount is actually distributed to the non-spouse beneficiary, it cannot be rolled over. That is emphasized again in question answer 15. Now, in question answer 17, basically in 18, we outline the minimum distribution rules, and they're probably pretty much what you would expect. If the participant dies before reaching the required beginning date, there is no required distribution for that year of death. However, the following year, we're under the 5-year rule or the 1-year rule. You know, basically the 5-year rule or the life expectancy. If it's after the required beginning date, then for the year of death, the minimum distribution still has to be made for the decedent. We cannot roll that over. The rest can be rolled over, and then we look to the standard rules for continuation of benefits after the required beginning date, which generally in this case is going to pick up either the life expectancy of the beneficiary, which is normally what we'd pick up as long as we have access to that or ability to use that, or the life expectancy of the decedent, one or the other, the longer of those two, you know, the remaining life expectancy of the decedent, shall we say, would be the one that we'd be using. Traditionally, if we have a younger beneficiary, the life expectancy of the beneficiary is going to be the driving number in this case. So basically, that's there. Key issue to remember on these provisions, check to make sure the plan allows it, discuss the issue with the client, and you have to get to the client before they take a check. Once they've taken a check and deposit in the checking account, we're done with discussing this issue. We have taken a distribution. Like the inherited IRA that they try to roll over that has to go from IRA custodian to custodian, this has to go directly from the plan to the IRA. They're not allowed to take this money out or do anything with it. If they touch the money, that's a distribution. Now, the other issue, Congress now continuing on, revised notices for plan distributions. This is, again, an issue you need to be aware of, or your clients need to be aware of, especially depending upon the nature of the plans they're working with and the type of support they're getting for handling plan issues. But Congress did require a couple of things. First, Congress expanded the period for notice. So basically, we go from 180 days from 90 days before. So we get into that. But then the second point was, we specifically added notice provisions, and this will change your notice, not just change the dates involved when we have to issue things. But we have to provide a description of your right, if any, to defer a receipt of a distribution from the plan, and we'll also describe the consequences of failing to defer such a receipt. So our notices to the employee when we make a plan distribution are going to have to describe these particular consequences of failing to defer. Now, the notice clarifies that the extended period applies only to notices distributed after December 31st, 06. So if a notice was distributed in December of 06, let's say December 10th of 06, it uses the old 90-day periods, not the 180s. Secondly, it also indicates, though, that even though we do not yet have regulations to implement the descriptions that, you know, it told us the IRS will give guidance and issue regulations that tell us how to implement these notices about the consequences, plans still have to comply with notice of consequences effective for all notices given for plan years beginning after December 31st of 2006. Now, question answer 33, basically, and question answer 32, we're told that basically we have to make a reasonable effort to comply. 33 tells us kind of a safe harbor test. If you do the following, you'll be kind of deemed to have made a reasonable effort to comply. And it gives two types of disclosure. If you have a defined benefit plan, your new notice needs to give, in a reasonably understandable form, a description of how much larger benefits will be if commencement of distributions is deferred. They don't take the money today. In a defined contribution plan, we're going to need to include a description indicating the investment options available under the plan, including fees that will be available if distributions are deferred, and the portion of the summary plan description that contains any special rules that might affect a participant's decision to defer. As you may note, in one sense, if you kind of read that, it seems the defined contribution requirements are going to be tougher than the defined benefit. That makes some sense because, remember, in a defined contribution plan, the performance benefits or losses go to the participant, so therefore there's more participant decision there. In a defined benefit plan, it's going to pretty much be autopilot. Basically, the employer makes up the shortfall if the plan doesn't earn out what it's supposed to. So in defined benefit, it's really simpler to describe the consequences of not starting distributions today. In a defined contribution plan, we don't know what those consequences will be. We can just tell you that if you stay in this plan, you'll have the following investment options, you'll pay the following fees, etc., and the other issues that may impact you if you leave it in here. So that deals with those particular notices. Key thing there is to try to make sure you have those notices updated. Finally, the notice describes the new options available for 2006-2007 for individuals to directly transfer funds from their IRA to a charity and not have to include that distribution as income. The problem we had before is I could take a distribution of $100,000 from my IRA. That would be included in income. That would raise my AGI. That would potentially disqualify me from certain benefits, let's say, of the tax code. It could potentially, of course, it would raise any of my phase outs that take effect based on AGI would be impacted by that. Things like the haircut for itemized deductions, the 3% haircut would be affected by it. The medical expenses would be affected by that one. The 2% for miscellaneous itemized deductions, those were all affected by increased AGI. The amount of my minimum tax exemption would be impacted by that increase in my AGI. Lots of things would be potentially impacted by the AGI change. So what this allows now is for certain taxpayers, for certain contributions, to basically have up to $100,000 transferred from their IRA account directly to certain charities and not have to recognize that as an income tax issue, not pick up the itemized deduction. In net, generally, that's going to put them in a better position if they had picked up the income and taken the itemized deduction. Now, this is only available to those who have obtained age 70 and a half. The distribution has to be made directly to the charitable organization. Cannot have the taxpayer take the money out of the IRA, then write a check to the organization. That does not work. The distribution has to be one that would otherwise have been includable in gross income and would otherwise have qualified as a charitable contribution under Section 170 without regard to the percentage limitations of Section 170B. So the fact that it's more than 50% of your AGI or would have been doesn't matter. That also may be important. If I'm making that $100,000 distribution and I have very little in other asset or other income for the year, my income would have come from the IRA, or at least my taxable income would have come from the IRA. Now, the limitation is, as the notice makes clear, $100,000 per owner, not per IRA. So if I have 10 IRA accounts, I still can only do $100,000 total. But if we're a married couple filing a joint return and both I and my spouse are eligible, we're both over age 70 and a half, then each of us can do $100,000 from our own IRAs. So I can do 100 from mine, my wife can do 100 from hers, and we're basically okay under these provisions. Now, there are some limitations on the organization. It's got to be one described in 170B1A, but that's other than a supporting organization described in 509A3 or a donor-advised fund in 4966D2. Therefore, just because the organization would have qualified for a charitable contribution deduction if it's one of these two tainted organizations, you're not allowed to do the direct contribution. And we'll talk about the consequence if you discover the client has made one to one of these organizations and what we do. What we basically do is restate things as if we had taken the money out and distributed it. But you need to be careful, and clients need to be aware that there are certain organizations. Sometimes you can solve this problem by, rather than giving to a supporting organization, you can give directly to the organization in question. And that would solve the problem of getting around the supporting organization. Why is this here? Congress has been concerned that these organizations, the supporting organizations and donor-advised funds, have been abused by taxpayers because the taxpayer has too much control in many cases in those areas. They don't, quote, totally believe, shall we say, the charitable contribution. Therefore, they're not going to allow you to run the IRA funds through there. You're going to have to run it through something more directly connected. That's why these got tainted due to abuses. This is not the only place where these types of entities get nailed under the Pension Protection Act of 2006. So you just need to be aware that they're out there. This is something, you know, these have had lots of issues that arise, so you need to be careful if you have one of these for lots of other reasons. But if you have a client doing the IRA issue, you just need to be aware these are non-qualified organizations. Now, there's a quirky restriction in the law that says you can't make this distribution from a SEP IRA or a simple IRA. Well, now this is kind of interesting because when you take a look at the law, in fact, it doesn't really ever, as an IRA account or an IRA trust, define something as a SEP IRA. Rather, and SEPs are the interesting ones, simples, we do have some special rules for simple IRAs, and those are special different types of account. But a SEP IRA in reality is a two-piece structure. The Simplified Employee Pension is the plan document adopted by the employer. And that simply says the employer will make a contribution, and that contribution will be deposited in an IRA account that essentially is like any other IRA account, except to the extent the custodian has put restrictions on it. But many IRA accounts will accept either employer SEP contributions or employee contributions. In essence, there's no special class of IRA accounts that are treated as SEP accounts. So despite the fact we see custodians label them that way, in reality under the code, they're just IRA accounts. So how do we implement this provision that it can't come from a SEP? Well, the IRS in implementing this in question 36 basically comes in and goes and looks for what they call an ongoing SEP IRA or simple IRA. Now, in the simple case, if we have it around for a long enough period of time, it converts to a thing that can be rolled into a regular IRA. Okay, so that's the second quasi, the strange set of rules for simples. Those, though, we do have special rules, but for a SEP, we had a problem. So what they do is they say if it's an ongoing SEP IRA or simple IRA, then that's a tainted one. Well, what's an ongoing SEP IRA? Well, an ongoing SEP IRA is any IRA account for which a contribution is made for the plan year ending with or within the IRA owner's taxable year. So if I have an IRA that receives for 2006 a SEP contribution from my employer, then that IRA account is for 2006 a SEP IRA. Now that's interesting because when you think about it, that means I could have made a transfer from that IRA back in September. That IRA could be funded much later with the contribution for 2006, and retroactively then it would appear that I have a tainted account, even if that account had never received SEP funds before this date. It suddenly becomes an ongoing SEP account, it appears under the notice. Second key issue. If I did have that $100,000 go into the account, let's say I had a SEP contribution go in for me back in January for 2006, so I know it's tainted from the start, but I want to take that money now and move it to the charity, it would appear that nothing stops me from rolling from that IRA account to another IRA account Once the amounts are rolled, they were fine and we're allowed to roll those instantly. And that rolled account, therefore, apparently does qualify for this transfer and automatic exclusion from income. I suspect Congress was concerned with people suddenly adopting a SEP as a backdoor way to make a large charitable contribution or doing something of that sort, as I presume why this is in here. But it certainly makes it kind of tedious to work with, and there are some traps for the unwary. Clients who expect to do this and who have SEP accounts would be well advised to set up a separate IRA account to handle the SEP monies, at least for these 2 years. And that account can sit there, and then you can roll out of it back into your regular IRAs. That's fine. But make sure that you don't have any chance of the contribution coming from an account that receives any money from the employer. It would also appear that any, including a de minimis contribution that went in from the employer into the account, would taint the entire account. Now, the notice goes on in question answer 37 to note that even if the beneficiary is over 70 and a half, if the beneficiary is over 70 and a half, even an inherited IRA that wasn't theirs could still qualify for this benefit. They must be over 70 and a half at the time this happens. But if they are, even though their age 70 and a half was irrelevant for purposes of determining distributions from that IRA, they can nevertheless make this distribution, and it would still qualify. As well, it clarified that if you put your money in before the president signed the bill, let's say somebody jumped the gun, heard Congress pass this, went out, immediately transferred it to a charity, the president didn't sign until August 17th. The law was retroactive for the entire year of 2006, so any contribution made this way during the entire year of 2006 would qualify, even if it's before the August 17th date that the bill was signed into law. Now, the amount's not eligible for charitable contribution under 170, no shock, and is not subject to withholding, probably also no shock. Now, the IRS did clarify that a check issued from the IRA payable to the charitable organization, then delivered to the IRA, delivered by the owner of the charity, will qualify. Again, a postman rule here. It cannot be one the taxpayer can negotiate. It would not work to have a check made payable to John Smith that he endorsed over to the charity. That would not appear to fulfill these requirements. It certainly doesn't work to have a check payable to John Smith that he deposits in his checking account, then he writes a check. That clearly fails. That distinction can be lost on clients. Be careful. Clients many times get frustrated, and IRA custodians are not known to be the most cooperative at times, especially when funds are leaving them. It seems to be that they're much happier to take them in than to let them go. And you may find a client wants to make this contribution to the charity, the IRA custodian's dragging his heels, so the client just wants to go shake the $100,000 check out, and give the charity a check for $100,000, and isn't that all the same? Answer is no. It's got to come from the custodian. And what you have to do is just force the issue or push hard on the custodian to get this done. It's also a major reason why if a client wants to do this in 2007, it's not a good idea to be waiting to the last minute. Custodians take a while to get things done, and if you're trying to get this done on December 31st of 2007, you may find yourself out of luck when you try to pull it off. One key issue at question answer 42 is that this distribution does satisfy any minimum distribution requirements under 408A6, B3, and 408 Cap AC5. This provides some real opportunity for clients, and I have a number of them, who are taking only the minimum distribution. They don't want or need the money, but they are charitably inclined, so they make significant charitable contributions. We can take their minimum distribution for 2007, transmit that directly to charity. They don't have to include the amount in their income. They've taken their minimum distribution, and they made their charitable contribution. This is a real opportunity in the right situation, especially if clients are losing benefits based on AGI. This could allow a significant amount of funds to basically go outside the AGI trap, potentially giving you a benefit for this year. Advisors need to consider pointing this out to options to clients. If you didn't do so for the end of 2006, and obviously things were a little hectic and this came in later in the year, but you need to consider it for 2007. The IRS also notes, kind of nicely, the Department of Labor has ruled that this is not going to be treated as a prohibited transaction. Remember, we can't assign part of our interest to a third party, but doesn't that look like what we're doing here? And if you have a prohibited transaction in an IRA, remember, that doesn't just taint the transaction. That kills the entire IRA and has the whole balance includable in income. Well, that would be a pretty big oops if that was true as to what was happening. but the Department of Labor has ruled they will not consider that a prohibited transaction. They also noticed that that was true even if the owner had an outstanding pledge to the charity in question. So the taxpayer has pledged to give the charity $100,000 this year. They can still use their IRA even though that is technically fulfilling an obligation they already had. The Department of Labor has ruled that it's not a prohibited transaction. They're fine with it. Now, not discussed in this podcast are a number of other provisions here I'll mention in passing that if you have this issue, these issues, you should review Notice 2007-7. There's a limitation related to the interest rate assumption under Section 417(e)(3) found in Section 303 of the Act. If you have that issue coming up, the new fixed rates of interest, those are described in there, the rates of interest per the rules. We have an exemption from the 10% excise tax on premature distribution for qualified public safety employees on Section 828 of the Act. If you have that situation, take a look at that, as well as the exclusion from income of distributions from certain government plans used to pay qualified health insurance premiums of an eligible retired public safety employee, Section 845 of the Act. Finally, there are revised vesting periods for qualified plan in Section 904 of the Act that shorten those periods up, generally for plans that were not previously treated as top-heavy plans. We basically shortened those vesting periods up. If you have such plans, there are required changes to the vesting periods you need to take a look at. If you have those issues, be sure to consult the notice in detail. Now, this podcast has been sponsored by Lineberg Information Services, located on the web at www.linebergservices.com. Be sure to visit there for information on the various tax laws we've had passed, as well as look at the information to make available to the subscribers. It's available to you at www.linebergservices.com. And this has been the Tax Update for Saturday, January 13th, 2007.